From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the writer Jim Holt works through this question. Why is there something rather than nothing? William James called it the darkest question in all philosophy. Religious people say existence comes from God. Atheists have sometimes dodged the question, saying, who knows? It is what it is, a brute fact. But Holt isn't crazy about that answer. He describes it as intellectually throwing in the towel. He says it's one thing to reconcile yourself to a universe with no purpose or meaning, but a universe without an explanation? That's not enough. Today in the program, Holt is joining us to talk about his journey to answer that question. He talked to original thinkers, physicists, and theologians and mystics, and his journey redefines the debate between rationalists and believers about the origins of the cosmos. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ever since he was young, the writer Jim Holt has been fascinated by the big existential questions. So when he heard the journalist Bill Moyers ask one of the biggest to the writer Martin Amis, he paid attention. Moyers asked him how he figured it was that the universe came into existence. And Amis said this, "We're at least five Einsteins away from answering that question." And so for Jim Holt, that made sense. But he wondered, are any of those Einsteins out there right now? And that was his quest, the thing that he was trying to do in his book, to answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing? Today in the program, Jim Holt is joining us to talk about what he found when he cast the net. He talked to philosophers and cosmologists and writers and particle physicists. His book is called Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story. Jim Holt writes about science for The New Yorker and The New York Times, his latest book I mentioned. And he's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Jim Holt, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I was made a reference there in the introduction to your first forays into existentialism. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. You were a high school student, you say, in rural Virginia. Callow and rebellious is how you describe yourself. But this is where...
Aren't all high school students callow and rebellious?
Yes, they are. Well, talk about what it is that really, because I guess it was Heidegger really that got you started, and you talk about being kind of bowled over by it all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was raised in a very devout Catholic family, and I went to a Catholic elementary school, and I lived over the hill from a Franciscan monastery, and I used to talk to the monks there about philosophy. And, you know, of course, the religious orthodoxy has a pretty simple answer to the mystery of existence. The universe exists because God created it, mm-hmm. and God exists because he contains the reason for his own being. Existence is built into his essence. And so, you know, that satisfied me when I was a child. But then as I entered adolescence, I started to have doubts about the religious story. And I went to the local college library and looked in the philosophy section. And existentialism caught my eye. It seemed like a nice, long, pretentious word. And I checked out a couple of books. I've always been pretentious, of course. I checked out a couple of books. And one of them was Heidegger's book, An Introduction to Metaphysics. Seemed a good place to start. You know, and the first sentence in the book was, why is there something rather than nothing? And I thought, wow, when it's put like that, it has such poetry. It's so beautiful. And I read on in this book and was rather distraught to see that it shed no light at all on the mystery of existence. Heidegger was it seemed like complete – I hope I'm not offending any continental philosophers here, but it was just a lot of obscure noodling. But the question stayed with me, and it stayed with me all my life.
You write in the book that for believers of God, for example, like your parents – there is no such thing as the mystery of existence. I mean, it's pretty simple. It exists because God made it so, and that's kind of the end of the story. And I guess this was part of your
unless you think it's a mystery why God exists.
Yeah.
The religious philosophers don't have a really good answer to the question, why does God exist? They have something called the ontological argument, which is a little bit like verbal prestidigitation, but I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you. But what I was going to say is that while I was writing this book, I began writing the book about 5 years ago, the question, why is there something rather than nothing? Why does the universe exist at all? Suddenly became a hot topic in the news because of the so-called neo-atheists began publishing their polemics. People like Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist, and the late Christopher Hitchens, and the philosopher Daniel Dennett, and who was the other, Sam Harris, all published books against religion, saying that we should give up the God hypothesis, leave religion behind, and be mature, rational people. And then the religious people, in fighting back, would cite the mystery of existence. I remember when Christopher Hitchens was on Sean Hannity's program, and Hannity said, "Christopher, if you don't accept there's a God, how can you explain why there's a universe at all? And, you know, what happened? What caused the Big Bang? What happened? What was going on before the Big Bang?"
Yeah.
And Hitchens actually said, "I'd love to know what was going on before the Big Bang." that's a good answer. Never at a loss for words, that man. And then Richard Dawkins said the same thing. He said, my religious friends are always saying that, you know, there must be a reason why there is something rather than nothing at all. So I was somewhat pleased to see that this question, which sounds like, you know, it's the sort of question that college kids having their late night rap sessions, if they still call them rap sessions, you know, bat around at 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. But suddenly it was an important issue being debated on cable TV. So I was very gratified by that.
Yeah, but there was no really good answer to it. I mean, as you've said, and I think probably Hitchens at that time literally did shrug. They just don't have an answer to it.
It's an important question. The hope, and this Richard Dawkins said, you know, we don't quite have a scientific explanation for why there's a universe rather than nothing at all, but we can kind of see our way to such an explanation. And then quite recently, just late last year, a physicist named Lawrence Krauss, a very gifted physicist and a very good writer, published a book called A Universe from Nothing. And Lawrence Krauss purported to give a purely scientific account of why there's something rather than nothing, of how the universe leapt into existence out of nothingness. And his book was reviewed by a philosopher and who has a PhD in physics, a guy named David Albert, in the New York Times Book Review earlier this year. And Albert said, "This physicist who thinks he can explain purely scientifically why there is something rather than nothing is so philosophically naive. All he's really explaining is how one something arose, how the current universe arose from an earlier state of something. But he doesn't begin with true nothingness." And so, once again, the alternative to the God explanation seem to be cast into doubt. By the way, there's a third possibility, and this was a third response to the mystery of existence. This was typified by Bertrand Russell, the great late 19th and early 20th century philosopher, when he was debating a priest on the BBC back in the 1940s. And he said, "Look, I would say the universe just exists, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
It's a brute fact, as you put it and as I put it. There is no further explanation for existence. We just have to accept it. It's just, you know, absurd in the sense that there's no reason for it." So these seem to be – when I set out on my quest to address this question, these seem to be the three possibilities: either God or science can explain the Big Bang, or there's no explanation at all. And I thought, you know, maybe there's some other suspects, cosmic suspects, so to speak, out there, and maybe I can find some of them. And I did. I found some rather interesting hypotheses that are not quite scientific. I would say quasi-scientific, where the line between science and cosmology and philosophy and even mysticism begins to blur a bit.
I wanted to go back. You write about how our outlook on the world, you know, on reality is something we inherited from Descartes, that there were really kind of two forms of substance. There was, you know, matter and mind.
Right.
And I wanted you to talk about that a little bit, because you spend some time sort of exploring all of this and the questions of, you know, how we started, how our thinking is sort of grounded now. And then there's that more abstract realm for you, which includes mathematics and mathematical entities, unthings, I think is how you put it in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about that, if you would.
Well, it's interesting, you know, as you said, Descartes, the 17th century French philosopher, who famously said, "Cogito ergo sum," I think, therefore I am, thereby demonstrating his own existence with absolute certainty. Descartes believed that, you know, there were two kinds of thing. in the world of being. There was physical stuff, you know, brute matter, which he called extended substance. And then there was mind or consciousness, which he called thinking substance. And this is, you know, pretty much the view of reality that we've inherited today. And one of the a very interesting philosophical and scientific question that's being pursued quite avidly by you know, teams of researchers all over the world is, how does consciousness arise from brute matter? And it may or may not be possible to give an explanation of how consciousness. I mean, just think how different consciousness is from brute matter. We have the, you know, how can you explain just from the bumpings around of elementary particles how sensations like, you know, the taste of peppermint or what it feels like to be pinched or have a headache or something like that. How can this sort of technicolor consciousness arise from dumb brute matter, just bumpings around of electrons and protons and neutrons? So basically, you know, whether we can explain how consciousness arises from matter or not, we still have sort of two types of you know, ontological furniture in the universe, mind and matter. Right. But there might be other possibilities. And why should there be just two substances? And one very interesting possibility, as you just mentioned, is abstract ideas, mathematical entities. Now, this was, you know, this goes back to the philosopher, the Greek philosopher Plato, who said that the world that we live in, the empirical world that we perceive through our senses, is just a sort of shadow or imperfect reflection of this timeless world of abstract ideas, which he called forms. And this Platonic idea is taken very seriously by, I would say, two-thirds of the great mathematicians that I've talked to. And one of the very greatest of them is Sir Roger Penrose, who was a collaborator with Stephen Hawking and proved some of the deep theorems in general relativity with Stephen Hawking. And when I spoke to Sir Roger, he was knighted by, I guess, by Margaret Thatcher. I'm sorry, by Queen Elizabeth. What am I saying? When I spoke to Sir Roger, he said he really believes that mathematical ideas are out there. They're independent of the human mind. They've existed eternally, even though the universe we exist in has only been around for 13.7 billion years. The mathematical ideas have always been there. And Penrose said that that mathematics sort of creates the physical world. And this, you know, this sounds like a kind of, you know, idea you would hit upon after you'd been spent all afternoon eating lotus leaves. I mean, it's it's like a pipe dream. But he takes it very seriously, and he elaborates it in a very beautiful way, which, you know, I can go into briefly if we have time. Perhaps I should.
It's as good a time as any because what I like about this is this really seemed in the book appealing to you in some ways, just because it didn't need a god, but it didn't rule a god out either.
It has a very pleasing – so Penrose's idea is, first of all, there's this eternal realm of mathematical ideas. And the best part of that realm is the mathematics behind mathematical physics. And that part of the realm sort of somehow gives rise to the physical universe. And in the physical universe, you know, consists of stars and galaxies and atoms and so forth. What's the most perfect and interesting part of the physical universe? Well, it's the brain, the human brain, or, you know, the brains of other creatures if they exist elsewhere in the universe. The brain is the most complicated object in the universe. It's the most complex, and the best brains, which of course for Penrose would be the brains of mathematicians, when they're all brains give rise to consciousness. So you've got first the mathematical world gives rise to the physical world. The best part of the physical world, the brain, gives rise to consciousness. So now you've got three worlds, the mathematical world, physical world, and the world of consciousness. And it's the best part of the world of consciousness, namely the consciousness of mathematicians when they're contemplating mathematical ideas, that sort of gives rise to the realm of mathematics. So it's kind of, you know, A causes B, B causes C, and C causes A. It's this sort of self-sufficient ontological loop of being that somehow, you know, floats above the abyss of nothingness. And so this is the vision I came away from in talking to Sir Roger Penrose. And I was very captivated by when I was talking to him. But once I was sort of released from the power of the sheer intellectual power of his presence, I thought,
from his spell,
that's crazy. Yes, exactly. I was under his spell, and that can't be right. It's a beautiful pipe dream, but it is a pipe dream. So my quest continued.
Yeah, of course. The question of why is there something rather than nothing? It's, you write about, you know, how profound and deep and troubling that question can be. But in the book, you also write about how it's really a question that doesn't come up until the modern era.
Yeah, that's because the ancient Greek philosophers and other early cultures before the modern era didn't really have a concept of absolute nothingness.
Yeah. It's
no accident that in the Roman numerals, there's no numeral for zero. You know, the number zero was introduced from Indian culture, Indian mathematics, by Arab mathematicians. Mm-hmm. In the 11th, 12th century. So in ancient time, they didn't have a concept of zero. And so to the Greeks, the great, and to other creation myths of early cultures, the great mystery is not how something came into existence out of nothing, but rather how a cosmos came into existence out of a pre-existing chaos.
Yeah.
So chaos is just a big primordial mess. And the idea is that a sort of, you know, a demiurge, some sort of a god-like entity arranges this mess into a nice cosmos.
Right.
And so that's the great question. How do you get cosmos out of chaos? By the way, the word cosmetic derives from the same root as cosmos. It's to give order to what's a mess, which is, you know, the case with many women's faces when they wake up in the morning. Oh, that sounded sexist, didn't it? Anyway. And how did I end up saying that?
Yeah.
So, by the way, I do want to stress that even though I myself am a lapsed Catholic, I did give a full hearing to the very best religious account of how the mystery of existence should be addressed. I went to Oxford and talked to a brilliant and profound erudite philosopher of religion and philosopher of physics, by the way, whose name is Richard Swinburne.
And
I'd read a book by him called "Is There a God?" when I was a book reviewer, and I'd reviewed it, and I thought, this is an especially interesting book. I've got to seek this guy out. And I went to visit him in North Oxford, and he had a little sat in a study with him, and he was sitting in front of a crucifix, and he began with the question, "Why is there something rather than nothing?" And he used the state of the art inductive scientific reasoning. What's the universe like? It's this. It exists. It's orderly.
Mm-hmm.
The laws of physics seem to be fine-tuned to allow life to come into existence, conscious beings like ourselves. What's the simplest hypothesis that explains all of this?
Yeah.
And his answer was the God hypothesis.
Right.
And he laid this out with such nuance and such logical care that I thought, you know, I'm almost ready to be received back into the church again. Anybody who thinks that religious believers are stupid or benighted or primitive should try to win an argument with Richard Swinburne. And by the way, he begins with the question, why does the universe exist rather than nothing at all? He proceeded in a circuitous but impressive logical path all the way to the incarnation and crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And I thought, just the sheer, you know, completeness of his vision. You know, I questioned a lot of his premises, and I wasn't satisfied with his explanation. I mean, particularly his premise that God is a perfectly simple being, because he needs that. For scientific reasoning always reaches for the simplest hypothesis, and for the God hypothesis to be a plausible one, it has to be simple. And so theologians have to say God is perfectly simple. And I said to him, you know, how can God be perfectly simple if his mind reflects, you know, all of the complexities of the world? He has to be at least as complex as the world. And Swinburne didn't buy that. So that's where we ended up disagreeing. But it was a beautiful, beautiful account. And I have complete respect for religious believers who do have a sophisticated theological understanding of existence.
Well, and you do push back a little bit. I mean, you in the conversation.
You're darn right, I do.
Yeah, I mean, you ask him in the book. You ask him you talk about him the conversation, how you really couldn't resist asking the question of Swinburne, you know, why God himself exists.
Yeah, and he doesn't hold with the religious notion that God exists almost as a matter of definition. There's this, you know, I alluded to it earlier, the ontological proof for God's existence, and that says that God is the most perfect being that, you know, by definition is the most perfect being that can exist, and it's more perfect. I mean, it's the most perfect being there is. And it's clearly more perfect to exist than not to exist. If you imagine a non-existent God, you can make him even more impressive by giving him existence. So God, you know, exists almost by definition. And Swinburne wasn't buying that. He said that's a medieval notion. It's not part of the traditional Judeo-Christian orthodoxy. So I said, okay, then why does God exist?
Yeah.
And he said, well, God's existence, it's just a brute fact. It's the, you know, you in explaining why there's a world at all and explaining the mystery of existence, eventually your explanation has to, your explanatory effort has to come to an end. And in my case, it comes to the end with the simplest hypothesis that there's a God. And I thought, well, if God's own existence is just a brute fact, if there's no reason for God's existence, you wonder, could God himself, if he exists, say, you know, whence then am I? You know, where did I come from?
Yeah.
Which is a sort of a haunting thought, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting. In a lot of these experiences, you seem, if not entirely convinced, at least initially, sort of taken up by the conversation and by the argument. And you talk about, after your conversation with Swinburne, you talk about this experience of wandering down the street and this kind of deep sense of contentment, some of which you've said had probably to do with the wine you were drinking. But it does seem you were sort of taken up by these experiences and really influenced by them, if not convinced. But you seem to be having a lot of fun, and you seemed really moved by a lot of these conversations.
Well, yeah. I mean, what could be more fun than talking to some of the greatest thinkers in the world and getting them to think out loud? And when you get a genius to think out loud, there's no telling what's going to tumble out of his or her mouth. Mm-hmm. And a lot of their ideas seemed almost shockingly not naive to me, but the sort of ideas that all of us, the sort of thoughts that all of us would have when we think about why the world exists and why we exist. And so I thought, you know, these guys and are not really that far ahead of the ruck of humanity. And so, you know, you and I mean, I'm not a philosopher. I'm just a journalist. So what do I know? But I thought, you know, William James said, you know, we're all beggars here when it comes to the mystery of existence.
Yeah.
And so it was oddly empowering to listen to these great thinkers think out loud. Sometimes they would say things of astonishing insight and genius. And sometimes they would say the very things that, you know, I'd been saying to myself all along. So, yeah, it was fun. I mean, my quest took a slightly sad turn toward the end, which we can get to later on. But when I, you know, of course, the question, why does the cosmos exist, is it sort of rhymes with another existential question, why do I exist?
Yeah.
And so eventually I had to confront the question, you know, what exactly am I? You know, Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. But what does the I even refer to? It's not my body. Is it my consciousness? When I look into my consciousness, I don't find any self. And what is the self? And then what happens when the self flickers into nothingness at death? And how does the self, you know, the 13.7 billion years into the existence of the universe, suddenly my consciousness flickers into being, and then, you know, 80 years later, poof, it's extinguished. That's pretty weird. But we should get to that perhaps later on.
Yeah. Well, Jim Holt is with us. His book is called Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist Jim Holt about his book, Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story. So I wanted to ask you about one of the most intriguing sections of the book. It comes early on, a conversation you have with Andrei Lind, this Russian physicist who teaches at Stanford, now lives in the United States. And one of the most striking things about his idea is that what he says is it's really, it doesn't take that much to create a universe. All you really need is, I think he said, what is it, 1/100,000th of a gram of matter.
Yeah, that's enough to Andrei Linda, who is a brilliant Russian-born physicist, as you said, at Stanford now. He is the author of the theory of chaotic inflation,
right,
which is probably the best account we have of the circumstances of the Big Bang. And it's a theory, by the way, that implies that we live – that the universe that we live in is just part of a larger ensemble of universes called the multiverse, which may be eternal. And the Big Bang that gave rise to our universe is just a sort of a local event. It's happened infinitely often in the past and will happen infinitely often in the future. Anyway, so Linda is a – and by the way, that theory of chaotic inflation, it may sound like crazy scientific speculation, but it's been very, very accurately borne out by the observations made by the COBE satellite of the so-called cosmic background radiation, the echo left over from the Big Bang. You can sort of study patterns in that and see that that they confirm this theory of chaotic inflation, which implies that there's a multiverse. Anyway, so this is Andrei Lind. I'm telling you, I'm giving you his resume.
Yeah.
But Lind was saying, you know, so he the amazing thing about inflation is that you can get a whole universe like the universe we see around us, the 100 billion galaxies, each of which has 100 billion stars, you know, inconceivably vast, out of almost nothing,
yeah,
by this mechanism of inflation, which he's described. And it involves fields. It's mathematically very complicated, very beautiful theory. And so this led him to wonder, since it's so easy to make a universe, and since there is, you know, a multiverse according to this well-confirmed theory,
mm-hmm,
could it be that our own universe was actually made by a physicist hacker in another universe? Because, you know, it's not that hard to make. You know, we don't have the technological capabilities. We could see how it would be done. So this hacker in another universe takes a tiny bit of matter and he subjects it to a sort of quite a lot of energy, the so-called Planck energy. You don't want to hear the technical details. And suddenly a baby universe comes into existence, and it doesn't blow up into the hacker's universe. It opens up another set of dimensions of space-time. And so, you know, this would be – this physicist hacker could be the creator of our universe.
Right.
You know, even if our universe was created by an intelligent being, it's not necessarily a god. It could just be a technologically very advanced being. And so he said – now, Linda said, if a physicist hacker created the universe that we live in, he would – you know, if you're going to make something like that, you're going to take an interest in how it develops. Would he be able to communicate with us, the
right
creatures within the universe he created? And that's where the theory of cosmic inflation trips you up.
Right.
Supposing the physicist hacker wanted to leave a message. Suppose he wanted to write in the heavens, remember that I made you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the universe starts – when the baby universe comes into existence, it starts expanding at this exponential rate according to the theory of inflation. And the message, remember that I made you, blows up into it's such a huge size that we would be living just in one tiny corner of one of the letters. So we couldn't actually see the message. So the only way that the physicist hacker who created this universe, according to this slightly cockamamie but very interesting theory,
yeah,
the only way he could communicate with us is by fiddling with the constants and the laws of physics and putting a sort of message in there. And so if there is a cosmic message, if there is a purpose and there a creator made our universe, only the physicists will be able to read it by looking at the gravitational constant and the fine structure constant and this sort of thing. So anyway, this all sounds a bit crazy, but this is wonderful fun, I think. And,
yeah,
and in learning about the idea that a physicist hacker could have created our universe out of another universe, you actually learn quite a lot about state-of-the-art, cutting-edge cosmology. And that's why I thought it was fun to pursue.
Well,
but I didn't take it seriously.
No, of course not. But it gives you a sense that, you know, the typical image of God as this omnipotent and benevolent being is kind of shot, because the person who started this particular bang, you know, could have been a complete idiot.
Yeah, and Linda said, "Look at the universe; it's kind of a mess. You know, there are wasted galaxies, and there's, you know, far too much matter to when you consider how little mind there is and how much brute matter there is. It's a serious imbalance, and you know, this is a traditional problem for religious believers. If God is all powerful and all good, then why is there so much evil in the world? And why is the universe in many ways so ugly if it's the expression of a perfect, infinite, infinitely good God?" And you know, I sort of humorously advance the alternative idea. Instead of being created by a being who is all powerful and all good, it seems that the world has been created by a being that's 100% malevolent, but only about 80% efficient.
Yeah.
That would explain everything. I hope that doesn't sound impious.
Jim Holby said, let's take a few calls. Mike is with us, calling from Orem, Utah. Mike, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Sure.
I just had a quick question and a comment. Last April, a Mormon apostle by the name of Russell M. Nelson sort of made this comment when speaking about you know, the singularity or the Big Bang. And he related it to a printing shop exploding and a dictionary being the result of that explosion. You know, he was inferring that that is how unlikely this Big Bang idea is. And my question is, you know, this ideas like this that are perpetuated typically by, you know, religious ideals, certain scientists like Richard Dawkins and even Bill Nye recently have been pretty outspoken about, you know, ideas such as this really do humanity a disservice. And I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Jim Holm?
That's a very interesting observation. That it was Russell Nelson who made that observation.
Right.
That
yeah.
It's a mystery in physics. It's one of the enduring mysteries why the universe at the Big Bang was in a highly, highly ordered state, which is very, very improbable. And this is a question that Roger Penrose, in particular, mm-hmm. is obsessed with. Why did the universe originate in this almost state of almost infinitely perfect order? And I think that's what your caller was alluding to, something like that.
Right.
There's no explanation for that now. And I can recommend an extremely good book by a physicist named Sean Carroll, who teaches at Caltech, I think, called From Eternity to Here. And he considers precisely this mystery of how the universe began in such an improbably ordered state. And if the universe came into existence by some sort of random mechanism, it's astonishing that it should have begun in such an orderly way. And so I think that's a fascinating question that was raised by the Mormon religious thinker whose name Russell Nelson.
Yeah.
And that your caller alluded to. And I do address that in the book, but it is deeply mysterious, and it's another reason to think that a purely scientific explanation for existence will never be satisfying. It wasn't even satisfying to Stephen Hawking when he set out the equations that he thought dictated that there must be a universe rather than nothing. He was still mystified by, you know, he said, you know, what is it that breathes fire into these equations and makes a universe for them to describe? You know, why does the universe go through all the bother of existing? And I have to say that other great scientists that I talked to, the great Steven Weinberg, who won a Nobel Prize in the 1970s, he's considered to be the father of the standard model of particle physics. He said that even a final theory of physics, a so-called theory of everything, would still leave a large residue of mystery. Such a final theory, it could not explain why it itself was true. And so science will always leave some mystery. And I think your caller was quite right to raise that that theme.
But I think the thing that seems to have troubled Mike, our caller, was that the conclusion by Russell Nelson and other believers is that the only explanation is that there is a divine creator who has ordered the you know, created the dictionary mm-hmm. out of all of this all of this chaos.
Yeah. So, what is the? I mean, some sort of principle. We don't necessarily have to personify the creator. I mean, that's certainly the way religious believers go. But
right.
There might be. You know, this could be a somewhat primitive attempt on the part of humanity's intellect to grasp something that is more abstract and more remote from our normal ways of thinking, which tend to personify things. When we see lightning, we think, oh, the gods are angry with us and so forth. And so I did – when I – you know, after giving a hearing to the best case that a scientifically astute religious thinker could make, that being the Oxford theologian Richard Swinburne, I went on to to take this in a more abstract direction, and I spoke to at great length to a Canadian cosmologist named John Leslie, who had another idea that was almost astonishingly implausible to me when I first heard it. He thought that the universe came into existence out of an abstract need for goodness, that it answered an eternal ethical principle. It's better that there should be something than nothing. And, you know, this is an idea, too, that comes out of Plato. And it sounds even more unlikely than certainly more unlikely than the God hypothesis at first. But when I spoke to Leslie, who's another brilliant thinker, he knows his physics, he knows his theology, he knows his philosophy. He made it into a beautiful logical system, and he answered all of my objections. And he didn't end up convincing me, so I continue with my quest. But so, you know, there's a suspect that I didn't think of when I first began exploring this. And I thought it was either God, science, or a brute fact. But then there's an idea that an abstract principle, like the principle of goodness, could have brought the universe into existence. And it could be the reason, if God exists, that God exists.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really do this justice. I know I haven't made it sound the least bit convincing, but it's a fascinating theory. And if you don't believe me, thinker I just alluded to, John Leslie, wrote a book published by Oxford University Press called Infinite Minds, in which he gives a rollicking, fascinating account of this. And you can learn a lot of science, a lot of philosophy, a lot of theology from it. It's a brilliant work in speculative cosmology. And, you know, this is just the sort of, you know, initially crazy sounding idea that I thought was worth exploring, because, you know, when you're answering the question, why is there something rather than nothing, if you don't, you know, if you if the answer, you know, seems strange to you, then, you know, that's not so surprising because the question's pretty strange.
Yeah. I like the section in the book where you talk about how the motives for pursuing the mystery of existence aren't just intellectual. You know, they're also emotional. You write about, you know, that the question you ask is what sort of emotion is appropriate when the object of that emotion is the world as a whole. And you talk about how there are two categories of people, those who, as you say, smile on existence and those who frown on it. Say something a little bit about the frowners first. I love how you put Beckett in there. Of course, that makes sense, afflicted, as you say, by the emptiness of being. And then there's Tennessee Williams and Jean-Paul Sartre, and Schopenhauer was a frowner.
Buddhism. I mean, philosopher Schopenhauer in the 19th century, who was the first Western thinker to import Buddhist ideas and ideas from the East into Western intellectual discourse, he thought the world was basically consisted of raw will, of raw striving, and that desire. And that desire was always suffering, because either the desire is unsatisfied and that's painful, or it is satisfied and then you're sated and bored. And so basically the world is a veil of tears. You know, this is also a Christian idea.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been better, according to Schopenhauer, if there had been nothing rather than something. And, you know, this is the idea behind the Buddhist program of seeking nirvana.
Right.
You know, nirvana is a state that you get into once you've sort of let go of all your desires. And when you do let go of your desires, the the seemingly substantial reality, which is structured by our desires, sort of fades into nothingness. And so I've heard, you know, Nirvana characterized as having just enough life to enjoy being dead. That doesn't sound like such a bad state to be in. But, you know, then there are people like Woody Allen, who interviewed a couple of years ago by a Catholic priest. And he said, of all people, and he said, you know, I think of the universe as a horrible, meaningless place of suffering. And we all go to our graves in a meaningless way, you know, and they're little bits of joy, but they're sort of overwhelmed by suffering. And, you know, we all do what we can to put up with it. I do a lot of whining and I make movies, Woody Allen said. Mm-hmm. But basically, it's just, you know, one long agony relieved by sort of, you know, little bits of joy and pleasure, which is, you know, I don't take quite that jaundiced a view of existence myself. It doesn't seem that bad to me. To John Leslie, the Canadian cosmologist I alluded to earlier, the world was infinitely good. He thought that it consists of, you know, infinitely many worlds, and our world, although it's not perfectly good, it's better than, you know, it's a little bit better than nothing at all. And so he imagined the being as kind of like the Louvre Museum. And not every painting has to be like the Mona Lisa. You also have a lot of, you know, fairly mediocre paintings in a big art museum like the Louvre, and that adds to the variety of it. And so our world, even though it's just a little bit better than nothing at all, because it contains a lot of evil, a lot of ugliness, a lot of waste, it still adds a little bit of goodness to the cosmic sum, and that justifies it. So, yeah, I mean, everyone, you know, I think that the astonishment at existence, though, is in a sense behind our religious impulse. And the great philosopher Wittgenstein, who said, you know, it's not the mystical thing is not how the world is, but that there is a world at all. And right. And he thought it was, you know, the astonishment at existence for him was one of the three experiences behind the ethical impulse. And by the way, the other two experiences for Wittgenstein behind the ethical impulse were the experience of guilt and the experience of being absolutely safe. And I think that makes a very interesting trio: astonishment at existence, a feeling of guilt, and the feeling of being absolutely safe. That's something to think about before you drop off to sleep tonight.
Jim Holt is with us. His book is Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So here's the question for today's program. Where did our universe come from? It's tough to explain if you believe in a God, tough if you don't. The writer Jim Holt set out to answer it, or at least get close to it anyway. He went on this epic journey to uncover past attempts and those working it out today. His book is called Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story. Let's go back to the phones. Mark is with us in Salt Lake City. Mark, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I'm halfway through a book called Biocentrism, and if I understand the basic premise of it, it talks about wave and particle theory and the process of observing a wave or observing a particle, and in that process it brings it into focus and changes its nature. And until you do, all these things seem kind of fuzzy and indistinct, but the act of observation makes them, you know, kind of solid, so to speak. And I think the basic premise is that he applies that on a universal level. The universe exists because it's being observed. And if it wasn't being observed by someone or something, it wouldn't exist or couldn't exist in the solid way it is. And I thought that was kind of interesting, an interesting take on it. And then my second point is when you were talking about, you know, the nature of a universe that's full of so much evil if God created it, my question is why did God create a universe so freaking big? I mean, there are 150 billion galaxies. Each of them has 100 billion stars. It seems like a slight amount of overkill, unless you're using it for some purpose. And that's what I'd love to ask theologians is, not only why does it exist, why is it so freaking big?
Did you ever ask that question, Jim Holt, to anyone?
That's, yeah, I actually, I mean, both of those are extremely interesting points. The first point the caller made, that the universe to exist really requires an observer. Yeah. This actually was an idea that a great physicist who died about 10 years ago named John Archibald Wheeler came up with. Wheeler, by the way, coined the term black hole, among many other coinages. And he was a teacher of Richard Feynman, whom some of your listeners may have heard of. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he called this idea the participatory universe. And the idea is that since it takes he thought it takes a mind to this gets a little technical here, if you to collapse the wave function in quantum theory, that the things aren't really real until the wave function collapses into a definite possibility, and that requires an observer. So the universe didn't really snap into focus, as your caller put it, I think, until it produced observers to collapse the wave function of the universe. This sounds very esoteric, but it's an idea that I do devote some pages to in the book, because yeah. Thought of by such a great physicist. And this also raises an interesting question. Could there be, if we do live in a multiverse, if there are many other universes, do all of those universes contain conscious observers? It seems to me that some of them could be zombie universes with no life at all, just as they're, you know, they're planets with no life at all. But that's just my own intuition. It's not worth it. The second point, why is the universe so big? You know, why so much stuff if, mm-hmm. you know, if perhaps we humans are the only civilization here? There are two ways. I mean, probably the easiest way to answer that is there's really not all that much to the universe, because if you add up all of the positive energy, which is locked into matter and exists in the form of radiation, it's exactly balanced by the negative energy of gravitational potential energy. And so the whole thing sums up to a big fat zero. So if you're going to create a world, you can make it as big as you want. It doesn't cost you anything, because it doesn't require any net energy to create. I know that's not a very interesting, you know, that's not a very satisfying answer emotionally, because when we look out at the vast starry heavens, think, you know, why so much stuff? But that's probably the scientific answer.
Mark, thanks very much for the call. I wanted to ask you, of course, you talk about that question, existence. You know, you're pondering it, you're working through it, you're having these conversations, and then you have this experience with your mother, which gives it another kind of resonance. And I wanted you to talk about that.
Yeah, well, when I was, as I said earlier, the question, why does the universe exist, sort of rhymes with the question, why do I exist?
Yeah.
And so I was writing about the self and about death. And when I was in the death chapter, which comes very near the end of the book, suddenly my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer, and she died just a month and a half later. While I was still working on the book, and I went to Virginia from New York, and I was alone in the room with her when she died. And many people have had this experience. You've seen a loved one die or someone else die, but in this case, it was my mother who engendered my own being, and here I was in the room with her. There were two selves, and then she flickers into non-existence, and now there's just one self in the world. And it really impressed on me anew the sheer weirdness of existence, which I had become a little bit inured to because I'd spent 5 years writing this book. But, you know, once again, it seemed at least emotionally mysterious to me anew. And that was after I thought I had solved the puzzle of existence. We don't have time to go into that. I know we're almost at the end of the hour, but let me just give you a footnote. There was a great philosopher at Oxford named Derek Parfit.
Oh, no, I do want you to talk about that, because it's such a – this seems like the most convincing thing for you in the book, this idea.
Yeah, I don't think it's convinced anyone else, though.
It's, right?
it's Parfit's idea.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'll run it up the flagpole and see if anyone salutes. And I haven't seen a lot of salutes so far. I find it fascinating. Derek Parfit, arguably the greatest living philosopher in the English-speaking world. He's a fellow at All Souls in Oxford, a brilliant, brilliant moral philosopher. And I can't resolve the puzzle of existence in the last 90 seconds here. But I can say that the Parfit solution, which I develop, it draws on two principles: the principle of simplicity, which is a bedrock principle of science, always reach for the simplest hypothesis, and a principle of fullness, which goes back to Plato. If you put them together and you do this shake and bake bag and do a little logical shaking, you get this very ironic conclusion that the universe the world should be a place, an infinite mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that jibes pretty well with my existence. A mixture, an infinite mixture of bad and good, of ugly and beautiful, of it should be as close, you know, as far removed from nothingness as it is from complete being. And, you know, the more we examine the universe, either, you know, the discovery of the Higgs boson, that Higgs boson makes the universe a messier and more complicated place than it would otherwise be. And in our own lives, you know, the weird mixture of purpose and meaninglessness, of suffering and joy. So anyway, that's a hint of the resolution that I came up with, thanks to a great thinker, Derek Parfit.
What I like about it, in a minute left, he says, you know, really, there's no clear boundary between philosophy and science on that question. It kind of merges those ideas.
Yeah. It blurs together in the end. You said if you're looking for the most general principle that governs the way reality is, it's not going to be purely scientific. It's not going to be purely philosophical. You know, all of these divisions 1,000 years ago will look hopelessly parochial. They'll, you know, we'll look like medieval thinkers,
right,
full of superstitions 1,000 years ago. But we kind of have a little glimmering of what our, you know, the future civilizations will come up with. And you know, that to me, that gives life some of the grace of tragedy, as Steven Weinberg once said.
Jim Holt. His book is called Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story. He writes for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Jim Holt, thanks very much for the time.
Oh, thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction today from Bob Nelson. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.